Blog Talk Radio.
Episode here of the Story Blender, hosted by author Stephen James. This is where you will hear great storytellers talking about great storytelling. Stephen will take you behind the scenes with his guests so you'll see exactly how the artistic mind works. Tonight's special guest is acclaimed novelist and a writing instructor, David Corbett. So you want to make sure you check that one out. Also, we want to let you know, of course, that all the shows here are brought to you this year by Kensington Books. Make sure you go to kensingtonbooks.com for more information on their authors and their books, like Kevin O'Brien and Lisa Jackson, just to name a few of the fabulous authors that they publish. Of course, subscribe to the podcast here on iTunes and search Suspense Radio. You'll see the logo and say, "That's what I want." Put it into your listening device so whenever we are finished with a show, it goes right on in there, and then you can listen to it whenever, however, and whenever you want to listen to it, you got it. So without any further ado, I want to now take it over to Mr. James and say, it's your turn, and here's the Story Blender with Stephen James.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James, and this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And this is going to be a really fun episode because I have a co-host, Amy Rogers, as well as a wonderful guest today. Amy is an author, publisher, and book reviewer for ScienceThrillers.com. She's a Harvard-educated medical doctor with a PhD in immunology. I can't even say it, let alone spell it. Kirkus Reviews said her latest thriller, Reversion, is a smart, tightly written, scary science thriller, and congrats on that, Amy. And also, please don't put any microbes in my coffee, if you don't mind.
Well, sorry to ruin the simple pleasures of life, but they're already there, Steve.
I remember the first time we met was up at Thriller Fest, and you were doing a presentation on your first book. I think it was called Petrol Plague.
Yes.
And you had created sort of this atomic version of the virus that you held up and showed to everyone in the audience out of, I don't even know, straws and balls or something. And you're like, this will kill you. And I was like, I like her. I think this would be fun to meet Amy.
Yeah, a little molecular model set that I had from college organic chemistry, and it sat on the shelf for a very long time before it got an application.
Well, it was, that's the only book that I remember anything about from that presentation that day was yours out of the 50 other people that were presenting, so it worked.
It did.
Well, okay, so our guest today has spent 15 years as a private investigator. David Corbett moved into practicing law and then, thankfully for all of us, into writing. The New York Times has called his work dazzling. He's a rising star who has found a way to write literary crime and thrillers that grab the attention of critics and readers alike. His book, The Art of Character, may very well be the best book on writing that I've ever read, and it was named by Barnes & Noble as one of the 5 craft books every writer must have. His novels have received a wide critical acclaim and been nominated for a variety of both national literary and crime writing awards. David regularly teaches the art of fiction writing at conferences nationwide. And David, I'm glad that you were able to join us today.
Me too. I look back on the day that we met back at Thriller Fest as one of the turning points in my career. I'm not making that up, Stephen, seriously. And I remember you said, well, I think you might enjoy my book. And frankly, your book, Story Trump Structure, is now one of those things that I don't think a week goes by that I don't either force it on a student or mention it on a blog, or it really was one of those eye-opening books. And so I'm very flattered that you think highly of The Art of Character, because it's a mutual admiration society. I think Storytime Structure is a great book.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, you know, and I know it's the same for you, but we take years and years of teaching and lectures, and we say, how can I, you know, distill this down into something that can really be practical for people? And I'm sure it's the same for both of us. I mean, we read a lot of work from aspiring authors. We teach a lot at events, and you start to find after a while that certain ways of explaining things really work, and certain ones don't. And it seems like a lot of people sort of just regurgitate the same ideas about writing at the different events, and I'll sit and I'll listen, but that wasn't the case with, you know, your book, and it's certainly not what I was trying to do with Storytime Structure. So, it's exciting. I read your book on a flight from New York City over to Paris last year, and kept me awake the whole time. So,
well, that alone speaks volumes. I've made that trip, not to Paris, but to Norway and to Turkey. My wife is half Turkish, half Norwegian, and so I do that intercontinental flight quite a bit. And there's to say that you could stick with one book for that entire flight is impressive. Thank you very much. That's quite a compliment.
Now wait a minute, half Turkish, half Norwegian. I love it.
I know. And they met in Boston. Her parents met at college in Boston. And
that's
cool. So, yeah, it is. They're a really sweet, lovely couple. And I get to travel to Turkey and Norway every year. So I'm like living the life, living the dream.
Excellent. Yeah, that's great. Well, let's dive into some of your thoughts on creating, stories of excellence. And I was looking over some of the topics of your lectures, and I noticed that one is called The Character of Plot. Mm-hmm. And I know that you teach a lot about character and characterization in fiction. When you talk about the character of plot, what tell us a little bit about what you're referring to.
Well, one, I steal liberally from this book I read called Story Trump Structure. But I have a bit more of a character emphasis in it, and I do believe that story is character driven, and I believe that, you know, without characters with profound desires, deep needs, stories ultimately are just one damn thing after another, and they lack the resonance that's going to make people remember them. So I'm always about, if you ground yourself in the right questions with your characters, you'll almost always be able to generate a story, because those deep questions will always go to, what do they want? Why don't they have it? What are they going to do about that? Why now? And just by answering those questions, you begin to realize, oh, well, okay. And then you can begin to proceed to realize, well, you know, if they don't have it, then something is standing in their way. It may be internal, it may be external, maybe both. And if so, then okay, then, well, how do they overcome that? Well, why doesn't it work? You know, just as you say, excellently, stories are about what goes wrong. And but once you awaken that desire, once the character wakes up and realizes, no, I really do want that, boom, the rest is just, you know, kick that horse in the rear and let it run.
Yeah, Amy, you've done many, many reviews. At least the last I noted, it was like 50 or 60 different reviews of science thrillers. Not science fiction so much, but sci-thri, you call it, which I love that name. But do you find that same thing true in the books that you've had to review over the years?
Well, I'm busy taking notes right here on what David has to say, so I can get back into the conversation here. Yeah, I have not done teaching of the craft of writing like you guys have, but I found interesting what you said, Stephen, about how the experience of teaching informs your ability to write a book about writing. That interaction with students and looking at a student's writing helps you to, you know, figure out how to teach better.
And you know, David, when you were – oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think writing reviews is sort of similar. I mean, you read a book critically and you can learn something about the craft of writing by observing how it's been done well or not well. And, yeah, definitely character is what distinguishes a good story from a great story. In science thrillers in particular, there's often, or in thriller fiction in general, there's often like a global calamity or some really big thing going to happen, but it's something that most writers know, that nobody really cares if the world is going to end we care that little Johnny's dog might die. You know, so you care about what the characters care about on a personal level.
Yeah, that's interesting, and what you were just saying bridges, David, for me with what Amy said. And I was this movie called Gone Girl had come out a year or so ago, and it was based on the book by Gillian Flynn. And but the week before the movie came out, I was watching some other movie at the theater. There's just five of us in the theater, and the trailer for the Gone Girl movie came on the screen, and in this trailer, Ben Affleck at one point says, "I did not kill my wife." And the guy behind me in the theater shouted, "Who gives a blank?" And I'm like, okay. And I don't know if he wasn't a fan of Gone Girl or if he wasn't a fan of Ben Affleck or whatever, but I thought, that is exactly the question we need to ask. When we look at our books, who gives a blank? And if readers don't, they're not going to care. Like what you said, Amy, we care about the dog, but the whole world, maybe we, I don't know, but we have to care. When that character has that deep emotional resonance, Dave, that you mentioned, I think it draws us in deeper.
Well, there's that. I just want to get back to Amy's comment. It called to mind Stalin's remark, which is the death of one man is a tragedy. The death of a million is a statistic.
Exactly.
And that's sort of chilling, but it kind of brings the chicken home to roost here, which is I love what Amy said about that it's the perspective of a certain character that makes these things meaningful. And I'm starting a new book, and I love the idea and everything, and I finally started getting down to it, and I said, yeah, but why is my character doing that? I can see, I had the action go, oh, you're going to be doing this and doing this and doing this, and I kind of go, yeah, but why? And I as much as I'm just like any other writer, you got to sit down and ask those fundamental questions. You can't shortcut it. You got to sit there going, and because the crucial question, and especially thrillers, is why not just stop? Why doesn't the character say, enough, I'm done, you win? Or it's somebody else's problem. I'm done for the day. Why can't they? And that question goes to what I call the yearning. And I call it that because it was Robert Owen Butler, I think, and I think it was at Norfest, I met him once, and he was talking about teaching, and he's in the PhD program at Florida State. And he said that, I probably get the best writing students I could ask for in the country. And they come to me with knowing 9 out of 10 things they need to know to write really, really good fiction. The one thing they almost never get is yearning. And I talk about it in terms of it's the person that the character wants to be. It's the way of life they want to live. And then the question is, well, then why don't they have it? And that's what they're going to have to overcome in an inner in the inner struggle through the course of the book. And I find that if you don't have that, very often the plot can just become one damn thing after another. And as you say in story time structure, Stephen, that action isn't what keeps us turning pages. It's tension. And why isn't the desire fulfilled is what creates tension. And beneath that is why does the character continue needing that thing despite the fact that they're not getting it? And I think that, more than anything, is the machine that really creates a good story.
That's cool. Can you give us an example from one of your books about the yearning where you had a character that you thought you did that really well?
Do They Know I'm Running was about a Salvadoran American kid who's 17. He's a guitar phenom. They're calling him the next Carlos Santana, and he's having an affair with a 40-year-old woman when the book starts, and he's just kind of, taking it day by day. And then what he calls his uncle, it's actually his stepmother's boyfriend. It's one of those families where his mom actually died when he was born. He and his brother were taken in by their aunt. Their aunt is now with this guy, so they call him uncle even though they're not married. But Tio Faustino, the uncle, gets deported. He's a port truck driver. And one brother has come back from Iraq and is so wounded there's no way that he can go down. The other brother in the family was deported and has just snuck back into the country, and he's not going to do it again, but he knows who to contact, and he doesn't want Tio Faustino to be on his own. He's 45 years old, you know, riding the train and everything else. They you know, they're going to rig it so that he can get a car and drive him up, and they'll make it that way. But the kid has to go down and do it. And at first, he's just doing it for the family. But ultimately, step by step, you know, he has to realize, well, what is it? And it ends up that he's there's a girl that he's told they have to transport as well, and she's being delivered to a drug lord. She's a singer, and she's going to be sort of like his prize. And I don't want to tell too much of the story, but when he goes through certain crucial things, he learns much more about his uncle and why he left El Salvador during the revolution. And his understanding deepens, he realizes that his debt to his family is much more than he thought. And so that it awakens him to just how much he loves these people that are his family, and how much he cares about, you know, people. And it's basically a coming of age story. He grows up and realizes the great cost that can come of just not, you know, just living your life day by day, instead of taking a stand and caring for people. And I think that you know, he becomes the person, you know, he wants to be, which is someone worthy of his uncle's pride and affection. Worthy of his brothers have always picked on him, and he wants to be the guy who can stand up to him. And they say, you know what, you did it. That deep yearning is what constantly keeps him going. And I think that's off the top of my head, that's the first example that came to mind.
Nice.
That's nice, and I like how you appeal to mystery. Now he has to find this information out. I was interviewing Jeff Deaver, and he said, nobody opens a book so that they can get to the middle. It's like nobody reads a book so they can get to the middle. He's like, you have to have these driving questions and mystery because you want people to, you know, read through and flip the pages and be engaged all the way to the end. And one way that he does that, at least, is through mystery. And I think it is, you know, I think that one of two things really drives us to flip those pages. Well, maybe a couple more, but really curiosity is a big one. Well, what's going to happen next? Concern, oh no, I think this is going to happen. I'm worried, you know, about this character. And sometimes we're just so entertained in what's happening that we kind of put up with plot flaws or glitches. We're like, this is so much fun. I just can't wait to get to the next page. So that anticipation.
Kate Atkinson is like that for me. I mean, I don't know how she gets away with page after page of inner life, but she does it so brilliantly. Her characters are so fascinating. I mean, she's almost an object lesson on what not to do unless you're brilliant. You know? And yet, it's exactly that enjoyment of that her insights continually engage. Her language is wonderful without being showy. And yet, you know, I know you're probably in the same boat with teaching. So much of inner life would, you know, beginning writers is navel gazing.
Yeah.
And instead of, I learned this from Oakley Hall in his wonderful book, The Art and Craft of Writing. And I went to Squaw Valley, so I got to, you know, take seminars from him. But he said that, you know, in Shakespeare's monologues, and monologues are very much like inner life in a novel. It's where the character is sort of speaking or thinking directly about whatever. And in Shakespeare's monologues, they almost always end with a resolution to act or a change of heart. And that's just that meaning that inner life needs to be towards something. It needs to be geared toward, I'm trying to figure this thing out, as opposed to just telling us what the character is thinking. You know, the character has to be trying to work through something, resolve something. If not, it's just a lot of blah, 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 blah. And that's and this is what's something I think that Kate Atkinson really gets. The characters are almost always in movement, even when you're alone with their thoughts. And she's just mind-blowing to me. But like you said, this is one of those things where sometimes the thing is just so doggone fun or interesting.
Yeah.
Even though it the concern or the curiosity may not be as intense, you're just wanting to say, yeah, just take me along. I'm here for the ride.
That sounds like a kind of a special case of the general rule that every scene, and in particular every dialogue, there should be some conflict in that. Would you agree that, you know, like if you're going to have an inner monologue scene, that there needs to be essentially a conflict, even though
yeah.
it's just the person thinking about themselves?
There has to be, yeah, it has to be a problem that they're trying to work through. And or there's, you know, or there's some difficulty that, there's a great scene in Clockers. Oh, great. I just spilled a whole bunch of tea. Oh, dear. Okay, any event, I'll take care of that later.
As long as it's not hot and on your lap, I think we're okay.
No, it's not. Unfortunately, it's cooling and it's on the floor, but I'm not at home. I'm at somebody else's house. So, yes, I will be dealing with this. But let's move right along here. What were we talking about before? My little mini disaster.
You mentioned something about Clockers, the movie, I think.
Yes. There's this wonderful scene where Rocco, the detective, comes home. And it's very late, and he has a rule that he's allowed to drink from the vodka bottle as long as it takes him to read the pledge on the side of the dryer's ice cream.
Okay.
And that's all he's allowed to drink. But his daughter is up. She's like, and she's just a baby. And he picks her up, and he begins thinking about himself as a father, and what his father was like. And you get the sense that he doesn't know what to do. He's just completely clueless about how to be a dad. But he thinks, I know how to act like a dad. Maybe that's okay. Maybe that's enough. And his working through that is a window into his uncertainties about himself. That is just fascinating. Does it push the story forward? Not really. But it's brilliant. And it's a scene that I have just never forgotten. He goes to the window. He says, okay, honey, say goodnight to the crackheads. Say goodnight to the werewolves. Say goodnight. And she goes, goodnight. Goodnight. And it's this beautiful, touching scene with this cop and his daughter. And you get a sense of his helplessness in some of the fundamental moments of life, like just being with your child. And it's such a window into his soul. It's wonderful. But, does it push the story forward? Kind of. It's a window into his soul, and we know more about him. We care more about him. And so we're willing to stick with him, during the other scenes in the book. But I know this is, I guess what we're talking about a little bit is, exceptions to rules or the corollaries to rules where this shouldn't work, but it does. And largely because of the writer's genius, but also because it touches into some fundamental question about the character that needs to be solved. And you can get away with these things as long as there is that question or a problem is trying to be worked through. I think that's when it works. When it's just, like I said, navel-gazing, then it's a snooze.
Yeah. Over the last year or so, I've really been thinking a lot about story and what is its essence. I'm writing a new book called Troubleshooting Your Novel, which will be out sometime later this year. But for me, I really started to come to understand story as pursuit. And it's something I had dabbled with a little bit a few years ago, but really this the idea of pursuit. Because if I'm pursuing something, I have desire. I want it. It's out of reach. I can't get it, or else I wouldn't have to pursue it. Also, that pursuit, the steps that I take in that pursuit, reveal what matters to me, what I'm like, who I am. And then either I'll get it or I won't at the end of the story, and we'll have that resolution. So it kind of has the initiation of the story, it has the tension of the story, it has the direction of the story, and the final transformation maybe of having or don't having what you pursued, and then the culmination and resolution. And so just trying to find ways to, teach people what lies at the heart of a story. And so I think there are moments and beats along this pursuit where we have these revelations, like in the scene that you just, described. And that was one of the things I really liked, David, about your book, The Art of Character, is it's a little different than other books. They always like, why is this character doing this? And then you write about it or something. In yours, you're like, okay, why is the character doing this? Now, don't write out why. You're like, instead, think of a scene where they can interact with people and it can be revealed. And I'm like, that's brilliant. That's exactly what we need to do instead of just, have writing exercises in seminars and so on where we explore the backstory and so on. The idea is, how can we encapsulate that in a scene and show who this character is through the movement, through the choices, decisions, and so on? So anyway, I really appreciate that. And do you want to jump off from there and take us a little bit more into depth about what you think of when you think of revelations regarding the characters and the choices that they make?
Well, the way I encapsulate what you just said is drama, not information. you know, the scene, and that was one of the things that, I mean, if there's unique ideas in Art of Character, that was one that just kind of came to me. And it came to me on my third novel. I'd done the first two novels by doing the usual character biography, and then finding that I just kind of discarded them.
Yeah.
And once I started writing scenes, the characters came alive. I kind of went, well, duh, because they're, again, pursuing something. They desire something. They're in conflict with other characters, and that's where character is formed, is in interactions, in wanting something, in not getting it, in having to make decisions on how you go about getting it. And so I just sat there and I thought, well, backstory is still important. I mean, I don't care what people say. Backstory is important. It's just that you don't do information dumps about it. You have to embed it in behavior. I'm doing an article, it's going to come out later this year, from Writer Digest, where Jessica Strausser, who you've had on, I understand. I adore Jessica. I think she's great.
Yeah, Jessica's great. In fact, we just recently had lunch. I was up in Cincinnati, and your name came up in our conversation. It was kind of fun, but I won't tell you what she said about you.
Okay. Great. I'll put that on a little hook and come back to it later. She said, you know, I'm always getting articles about the importance of backstory or non-importance of backstory and so on and so forth, but what I've never had is, where do you put it? And I thought, oh, great, I'll do that. And, you know, sent the email and then went, what the hell was I thinking? I don't know how to solve that problem. and then I had to think it through, and it made – I had already thought about, you know, the examples I often use are Casablanca and Chinatown, where we see backstory in behavior. We don't understand it until the middle of the story. And I think James Scott Bell is working on a theory. He was talking about this last year at Thriller Fest, and I think he's working on a book where he calls the mirror moment in the middle of the film, where the character very often, because of the failures in trying to, you know, to get what he wants, has to look at himself and say, what is this about? What am I doing? Why am I doing this? Those fundamental questions. But if you put that in the beginning, you're front-loading a lot of cerebral stuff. Instead, you just show them acting in accordance with the mistakes they've made and the compromises they've made. I mean, Jake, you know, is a flashy dude trying to show that he's on top of things. Why? Because once, when it really mattered, he didn't know what was going on, and somebody ended up dead, somebody he cared about deeply. And he's decided, you know, I'm never going back there. I am literally, in every way imaginable, never going back to Chinatown. And, of course, the whole movie is about how he gets back there. And in Casablanca, you know, I mean, Rick has his heart broken and becomes a cynic and decides to forever leave behind the things he believed in before. And when we see him, he's the king of hell. You know, he's in Casablanca. This is how he's decided to live his life. When Ugarte gets killed right in front of him, and somebody says, "I hope you just don't stand by there and stand there and watch when they come for me," and Rick says, "I stick my neck out for nobody." Well, how did he get that way? We find out later, but we only see it in behavior at first, and those moments of revelation have to come later. They can come in little asides at first, but ultimately, until the character faces a crucial moment where they have to ask, "What am I doing?" I mean, once Ilsa shows up, you know, and then leaves saying, you know, he just curses her and is mean to her. And you wonder, what the heck is going on? Boom, then we get the flashback. Then we see Paris. In Chinatown, it isn't until he and Evelyn, you know, are in bed together. And Evelyn does the great thing, which all women do. You know, they go to bed with somebody, and the first thing they want to know is, who are you?
Yeah, that happens to me all the time.
And that's a great place to slip in backstory. And she's questioning him. He doesn't want to talk about it. And this, as Amy was saying before, you know, reveal through conflict is one of these little rules we constantly learn, and it's done really brilliantly in that. You know, you don't like talking about the past, do you? He says nobody who worked there did. Worked where? Chinatown. Why not? You never knew what was going on. And it's those, you know, you're aiming for, if you need to explain the backstory, you have to get to that point where the character's need to explain is justified by the story. And that, for me, that's where these reveals make most sense. And it's almost always at a point in the story where things have gone terribly wrong, or in the case of Chinatown, where a bond has been formed and now needs to be solidified. And she's basically saying, you know, can I trust you? And he's having to prove to her that she can.
Yeah, you mentioned how you'd done those background, information kind of histories or whatever of the characters with your first couple novels. And I don't really encourage that so much, because I do think it often they get either discarded or dumped in, like in a way that you don't want.
Yeah.
It's not in the way that you just described, but instead you read the first, you know, chapter or something, and then the second chapter is all of this history. And my view is that history is what happened to the character before the story, but backstory is what happened to the character that matters to this story.
Yeah.
And I think there's a big difference in this idea of including the history. I never want to include the history. I want to understand maybe some of the history, but I want to include whatever backstory is vital to this story.
Yeah.
And also,
and if it isn't vital, go ahead,
Amy. Of creating a little bit of the mystery, like you were talking about. You know, if you don't really understand this character, if you haven't been told everything up front, you wait until that critical moment that David's talking about, it creates some questions in the reader's mind as you're going. Why
right.
Why is this guy such a jerk?
Yeah. Why do I care about this dick? I need to keep turning pages so I can find out.
That's true of, I think, some movies and some of the binge-watchy films and shows that people are watching these days is people, you know, will say, I don't like this guy, but I want to find out more. And they'll, you know, watch House of Cards or something where, you know, you're like, Kevin Spacey's a psychopath, but I want to watch more. It's like, wait
well,
a minute.
House of Cards in particular, you know, does the Shakespeare trick where the character is lying to everybody except us.
Hmm.
Iago and Richard III. I sat there, and when I was listening to it, I was going, this is Richard III. This is him turning to us. And because he's talking to us, we put up with it. It's amazing. I mean, he's doing hateful things.
Right.
But he's being honest to us. And it is this marvelous trick that I'm just stunned by how well it works. And I have this whole thing about the anti-hero. Anti-heroes have a tendency in history to crop up when a culture's fundamental truths are in question. The first time you see anti-heroes, I mean, Odysseus might be considered an anti-hero, and the Romans got rid of him because they hated him. He was just like, he defied their concept of honor, and Virgil curses him every time he brings him up in the Aeneid, and he just kind of vanishes. But then the picaresque novel came about when the Habsburg Empire was beginning to decay and beginning to, its internal contradictions, as Marx would say, began to reveal themselves. And so instead of these chivalric romances, you know, and all these great heroes that appealed to the ruling class, the people wanted heroes that they could believe in, and they were rogues and scoundrels, not murderers. I mean, they weren't really evil people, but they were clever and defied the standard moral code of the time. And I think that we're seeing a lot of anti-heroes now for precisely the same reason. I think people have lost faith in institutions and lost faith in standard, you know, the morality, because nobody is living by it. So they want to see a character who's struggling with, well, what's really the right thing to do in the same way that they are. I also believe, though, that the other reason we're seeing a lot of anti-heroes is they're a great way to drive a five-season TV series, because you never know which way they're going to go. You know, it's not like they have a fundamental understanding and then reform themselves like you see in a number of novels. That devil is on one shoulder and the angel is on the other, and they're both yammering away, and either one could get the upper hand at any time. And you can create a lot of episodes out of that.
Mm.
So those are my two takes on anti-heroes.
That's great. That's really interesting. You're right. We have seen in the last decade, maybe 20 years, just this incredible rise of anti-heroes in fiction and movies and film and television. And sometimes people make the mistake, I think, of going too far in the other direction. Like, there have been some TV shows I've started to watch, and I'll watch half an episode, and I'm like, there is nobody on this show that I want to spend time with.
Yeah.
So I'll stop. Because I think they're trying too hard to get this angst, or I don't know what they're trying to do. But I'm like, I just don't want to be around any of these people. Then there are other shows where they're intriguing, and I think, I want to be around this person. I don't know if I like him or not, but I want to find out more.
The key is you as the writer have to care. And I think that if you don't if you as the writer don't somehow share in the humanity of this character and can't somehow engage with that, it's going to come across as being contrived and kind of phony, and you're going to sit and go, he's just creepy. I had this problem with Ray Donovan. I just could never really relate to because he was a PI working in Hollywood, and that's work we had done. I mean, I know this kind of guy, and it's kind of based on Anthony Pelicanos, and who was called Thug to the Stars. I don't know if you know about this guy.
He's
in jail now for wiretapping people at the behest of his clients, and it's a that can be a fascinating thing. But the problem is Pelicanos himself was just a scumbag, and Ray Donovan never seemed to. I never saw the moral center of him that made me say, no matter what you do, I get the fact that you still have a moral compass. And I think without that, you know, without some concern for other people or some sense that I have a code, it's not your code, but I do have a code, I think that, yeah, you can just, these characters can become just an exercise in negativity. And who cares? You know? I can watch Fox News for that.
In Amy, in the novels that you've written, have you tended to have anti-heroes or heroes, or how does this relate to some of the characters you've developed? Amy?
Oh, me? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just curious. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, David is interesting, right. But you know. I don't want to hear him the whole time. I'm just kidding.
Yes, of course. My heroes, my protagonists tend to be a little bit more straightforward. I have never actively tried to write an anti-hero. I'm more interested in terms of incorporating a character who's got negative traits but is still likable. I'm more interested in the villain. And I definitely, in my books, do not have, you know, generally have big bad guys. I have people who have oftentimes sort of accidentally ended up being in a position where they now are making choices and doing things that cause problems for other people. So not necessarily because there's an intent to go out and cause mayhem. So I think that's sort of the flip side of what you're saying about the anti-hero, is that the antagonist or the villain in any story is usually best if it is a person who has redeeming qualities, who has something about them that we find intriguing, and someone that we want to, in some level, perhaps even root for, as the story goes along. Since I write books, my books are all science thrillers. They have typically microbiology in them. So, in some sense, the villain in my stories is a microorganism, which does not make a good character. they are often, in a sense, driving the plot. What the microbe does is what the protagonist has to fight back against. But because, you know, they're microorganisms, or the villain, they're doing things that cause some of the human villains to have to make choices and respond to what's happening with the infection in ways that then, you know, put them in conflict with the protagonist.
So, yeah, this is good. The whole idea of moral dilemmas and not caricatures of good, of evil, of right and wrong, but exploring where they overlap a little bit. I like that. And actually, David, that's one of the things, too, I liked just looking through and reading your book, The Art of Character, was this idea that don't be afraid to explore the beliefs of your characters, their religion, their faith, their convictions, their virtues, their vices. And I think people do shy away from the idea of exploring people's faith and religion in a lot of books. And I was just curious, why do you think that is? Why do you think people shy away when that's such a vital aspect of so many people's lives?
I think one is that they're afraid that, okay, the minute I mention faith, I'm going to turn off any readers who don't want to be proselytized. And there's a fear that the minute you bring up faith, you're going to be banging a Bible. And I think that's one reason. And I think another reason is that I think a lot of authors themselves are sort of ambivalent about it and or are actively non-engaged with faith anymore. That seems to be the great, you know, move toward secular whatever, even though most people call themselves spiritual and not religious or whatever. And I just find that, as I said in Art of Character, I said, maybe you don't adhere to a certain faith, but the questions that faith seeks to answer are the questions you should be asking in your book.
Yeah.
It's just, and so, you know, you can, if you give a character, you know, a certain faith system to believe in. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and the standard thing, I was raised Catholic, meaning, you know, I'm no longer a Catholic, you know, I no longer go to church and so on and so forth. But they gave me, one, an intellectual discipline, and two, a cultural viewpoint that I still refer to quite a bit. And yeah, I probably now lean more toward the Stoics, but the Stoics were really instrumental in Catholic theology. So it's really not that far of a reach for me. And Pema Chodron's book, you know, When Things Fall Apart, was the one book after my wife died that saved my life. I mean, somebody tossed that lifeline to me, and it was really, really crucial. And so I think that these questions, why am I alive? Why am I still doing this? What is the right thing to do? What is the wrong thing to do? These, you know, all these questions get asked within faith traditions, even if people within those faiths don't adhere to the logic or the belief system themselves. I mean, we all have, you know, we all know people who are arch hypocrites who, you know, nevertheless can't crow their faith loudly enough. But even that's an interesting character. Why do they do that? And so I'm not really sure, especially in America, which is an incredibly religious country, probably the most religious country in the world. I don't know why people shy away from it. I think it's fear that you may alienate readers, and I think it's a discomfort on many writers' parts themselves to sort of go there. That's the only thing I can think of. I'm not really sure.
This is a fascinating question, actually, Stephen. I'm intrigued that you brought it up. I'm just sitting here trying to think of the last time I read a thriller that had any shred of religion or even spirituality in it. Like, I'm trying to think if there was ever even a scene where somebody, you know, says a little prayer. I think in some of your books there are some moments like that. But in general, it's totally absent. So it's almost like we're not even, we're, you know, it's not even that we're, you know, the writers are being worried about being inclusive. Like, if I write about the Catholic experience for one of my characters, people who are not Catholic won't understand. But even just that moment of a real spiritual touchstone of a character taking time to, you know, to think in a spiritual way or to reach out to some divine power, which, again, like you say, most Americans claim to be, you know, to have that aspect of their lives, even if it's not part of an organized religion anymore. You just don't see it.
I know, and in my books, I try to do, you know, what David said, and that is explore some of these big questions of right and wrong, of good and evil. Does God exist? Does he not? Does it matter? Does he care? You know, does my life have any, you know, lasting significance? Do my choices matter? Is there such a thing as free will? What's more important, truth or justice? And, I mean, all of these, to me, are what make stories vibrant and alive and actually matter in the long term. I mean, you know, there's thousands and thousands of books being published every week and probably every day even, you know, thousands of them. And so many will just pass away to the side. But I think the ones that have lasting value are the ones that ask big questions. And as long as we're too cowardly to ask those questions, or maybe not cowardly, but, you know, don't have the wherewithal or something to go there, I think our stories probably aren't going to last and be told and read that long.
I'd agree.
So I was thinking, too, about, David, about some of the lectures and teaching and seminars that you give. What are some of the kind of most common mistakes or weaknesses that you're starting to see over and over maybe in aspiring writers these days? I know some of the things that I tend to see, but I'm curious if it's some of the same stuff that you see.
Well, I have to admit that, again, getting back to, I see writers who are more than capable of saying, well, this is what happens. And you want to say, well, why? And You know, and that ultimately gets down to, you know, why doesn't the character just walk away? Why doesn't,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, and I find that a lot of beginning writers are really good at creating events, but not story. And story, like you say, is about pursuit. But underlying every pursuit is that question, why? I think that's probably the biggest thing. I'd also just say there's a general degeneration of skill in language, syntax, punctuation.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many times when I'm teaching things like character where I say, you know, I think you really ought to take a general composition class, because you really don't get sentences, paragraphs, and stuff.
That's the basic.
Kind of crucial.
Yeah.
Although in some ways that's the easier part to fix.
Yeah, it is. But it's not. The thing is, if I start doing that, then I never have time to get to the bigger stuff I'm trying to teach with the class. It can really just, it can be such a time suck. I'm editing a memoir right now, which is brilliant. I just love this woman. I love her story. It's about a man who spent 20 years in prison for a murder that he claims he didn't commit. And he's African-American, and she met him when he was a boy. He was bussed into their neighborhood, and he became friends with her son, and then they lost touch. And one day she picks up the Boston Globe and realizes that on the third trial he's been convicted of killing this police officer. And for 20 years, she could not get involved. She could not get involved. She just it began to eat at her, and she became friends with the family and closer to him, and became a proponent in writing articles for him. And ultimately, he was given a new trial, because the police officer who was killed and the two guys running the investigation were all corrupt, running a drug business on the side. And so there was all these things. But the thing is, she's a nonfiction writer, and she's not used to dialogue.
Aha, yeah.
And so I'm having to, you know, basically on a real nuts and bolts level, saying, okay, what is dialogue supposed to do? Why is it here? She's great at exposition. And a lot of the exposition is great in the book, but it's one of those fundamental skills that if you don't do it, you're not going to know. And I find that, you know, dialogue often, especially speech tags, those things drive me crazy. you know, nothing is a bigger speed bump in a story than, you know, she exclaimed, or, you know, all
she chortled.
Yes,
yeah.
Oh, chortled, yes. May no one ever chortle again. I make the point in Art of Character, you know, sometimes they'll say, you know, not at all, she laughed. I go, you can't laugh and talk at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, there's a word for that. It's called coughing. You know, and, you know, don't be colorful in your speech tags. Make the dialogue do the work. You know, and these are kind of the fundamental things. I would say that's another one. Letting dialogue do the work as opposed to trying to make colorful speech tags and such. Oh, boy, I run into that a lot.
That's funny, though, about the speech tags. I know that's the standard. They used to describe them as a speed bump for a reader. I mean, you're suggesting that as a reader, when you read them, you're like, eh, you cringe, you know. That's a cultural shift, right? I mean, didn't those used to be more a standard part of writing? And I guess
go back and get D.H. Lawrence.
They used to like it, or they were used to it, or whatever. I mean, that's kind of a strange thing that's happened over time.
Well,
yeah,
ever.
It has. You know, it has definitely happened. And
there's a I can't tell you how many times, especially mystery conferences, where, you know, we're very much beholden to the type of prose, you know, Hemingway prose, because that got developed by Hammett and Elmore Leonard, and there's that sort of tight, clean, and adverbs cause cancer. You would be the subtext you'd get from many of these panels, you know. And, you know, and the Brits just look at us like we're insane.
Yeah.
And especially in speech tags, because, you know, she said, ironically, they can get away with that. For some reason, though, it's like in America, if you put an adverb with a speech tag, and I'm one of them, too, I kind of go, nah, don't really want it. Mm-hmm. And yet I read Brits doing it all the time, and it works. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever read any of the Harry Potter books, she does that in almost every line of dialogue. She said wearily or whatever. I read one of them. I'm like, are you kidding me? But, you know, she definitely did get away with it. One of the funny things that I keep seeing in aspiring writers is eyebrows. Her eyebrows furrowed, raised, dove. I'm like, just you get one eyebrow reference for every 100,000 words. That's it. Nothing more with eyebrows. I don't want to read about another eyebrow.
Karen Ballard talks about that. She says that, especially beginning writers, that they have a tendency to think of dialogue in close-up.
Huh.
And that almost everybody's like people, they're either doing, they're smiling or they're twitching or they're pushing their hair back. And she goes, it's almost like this litany of tics.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, move back, look at the room, what else is going on?
Hmm.
You know, and don't confine, you know, setting is a great way, you know, when you have the little action beats in between lines of dialogue where you're trying to create a pause and doing it with language. You know, don't just have the characters doing it. You know, show something else happening. You know, expand your view of the room. Get more context into the dialogue so that it isn't just this constant where you feel like you're watching their lips move.
Okay, I'm writing that down. That's a good tip.
Man, I wish we had more time, but we need to close up here in a moment. Dave, this has been really, really great, good conversation, and I want readers to go not only to buy your book, but to go to your conferences and seminars. Where's the best place to find out about your speaking schedule when you're at different events around the country?
Oh, definitely my webpage. I do try to keep it current, and I do a reasonably good job.
which one is that again?
That would be davidcorbett.com. And
excellent.
Corbett is Corbett.
And please do go check that out, and also buy the book, The Art of Character. And you have a new novel that you said you're working on?
I'm working on, yes. And I'm one of those people who never talks about what I'm working on.
Ah.
Except that I will say that my agent said, I want a woman protagonist.
Well, all right.
So,
that's a good teaser.
And it's fun. I'm having a great time with this.
And we know what she's going to do. If she gets in bed with someone, she'll say, who are you?
Who are you?
We already know that much about
her. Next morning, she'll say.
So let's just say that I am adhering much more to your notion of pursuit as opposed to acquisition in this one.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
So, Amy, your book, Revision, came out recently, and we want people to check that out. Where's the best place to find out info about your writing?
AmyRogers.com, R-O-G-E-R-S, no D in my name, summarizes everything that I'm working on and what I've done. And if you're not satisfied with just looking at my stuff, if you like science-themed fiction, go to ScienceThrillers.com, which is my book review website, and there's over 100 reviews that I've done there of books in that category that have real science, medicine, and technology in the plot.
Excellent. My next novel writing intensive will be in Dallas. Coming up in the fall, we're starting to take registrations now, so check out novelwritingintensive.com. And, of course, for more info about our guests and to check out other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember that the art of the story is all in the blend. Friends, we'll see you next time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.